Great question. The Manufacturing Podcast offers news and information for the people who make, store, and move things, and those who manage and maintain the facilities where that work gets done. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of Great Question, a manufacturing podcast brought to you by Endeavor Business Media's Manufacturing Group. I'm Tom Wilk, the chief editor of Plant Services Magazine. We are lucky to be talking again today with Brian Hrontrek, who is a principal trainer and consultant at Aradicio. A couple of lines in his CV include the fact that he was a reliability engineer for U.S. Steel. He was a maintenance manager for ExxonMobil, and he is also a 16-year veteran of the Marine Corps, working for much of that as an aircraft mechanic. So, Brian, welcome back to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, and I enjoyed our first conversation, which focused on the more theoretical aspects of an FMEA. What is it? Why do you do it? What's its position when you're building a maintenance strategy? And I'm really happy that we get to talk again today, because what we didn't have time to go over last time were the actual nuts and bolts building blocks of what this thing is and how to do it. So thanks again for being here. And that's the big question we're going to answer today is, all right, how do you do this thing?
How do you do this thing? No, it's such a great question to ask. And, you know, my own experience, you know, walking in as a reliability engineer and learning these tools, you know, as I was earning the CMRP, you know, and going in and stumbling over it a lot of times. It's like, well, how do I answer these questions? What's the difference between, you know, the failure effects and the, you know, the you know, things like that? How do I answer, you know, what's in these blocks? So what I want to talk about today is really, like you said, demystifying or putting a little strategy behind this, because everything we do should lead to something else. And this is no different. If we do this right, it's going to answer so many questions downstream that it's just going to make the next step even easier and the next step even easier until we have, you know, a plant that's running, you know, really well.
When we were talking about this before recording, you mentioned that one of the first questions that I think people wonder when they're about to engage in one of these is that somebody has to make the FMEA happen. Someone's been directed to in the plant, or someone thinks they have to do it, but no one's given that person any direction. Right. They're the ones who know they're responsible for it. They want to be responsible. And yet, what do they do first? Where do they look? If you were there with them on the plant floor, what would you tell them on? What's the first steps here?
So the first thing to understand is that your chain of command, your bosses, you know, up the chain, they want you to do this because they know it's the right thing to do, but they may not be the technical expert in it. So ask a few questions first. The hierarchy, if you've done a good job on the hierarchy, then all of your assets that are like should be at the same level across your whole facility or across your whole business, right? All of your motors should be at level 8. All of your pump skids should be at level 7, right? All of the process sections should be at level 6 or something along those lines, right? And the reason that's important is because you need to go back to your bosses and say, what level are we doing our FMEA at? What level of the hierarchy? Are we doing it at 6, which is a little bit higher, which means we might get through it faster, but it may be a little bit less valuable for us, right? Or are we doing it at level 8, where we're going to take a lot of time to get it done, but it's going to have more that can be duplicated, and we're going to have a much more granular view of the entire business and exactly what is important to the business versus not. Because if I go to level 6 and I'm looking at a humongous, like an overhead crane, right? And we say, well, it's a critical crane. Yeah, but you know what? The door latch on the cab is not as critical as the hoist motor. Hmm. So you can't just treat everything on the crane as critical.
Right.
So if we get down to level 8, then we're able to differentiate between the motor and the latch and the door and all those different things, right? Focus exactly where we need.
Hey, and before we go down this road much farther, I wanted to ask, what kind of work normally has to be in place before you do an FMEA? Are we talking about there's got to be some sort of criticality analysis in place at the very least? Anything else has to happen first?
Yeah, hierarchy first. Build a good, strong hierarchy. That's the foundation of your reliability engineering efforts, right? Criticality is second. With criticality, now you can do an FMEA without criticality, but that just means you're going to be over maintaining your assets, or you're going to be misguided in where you're applying your efforts, right? So do the criticality and take that top tier. Pick it for your business. Is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 20%? What percent of your critical of your assets are going to go through the FMEA process? and then start working through that level, only those assets first.
Okay. Okay. So no, thanks for going over that. So you've got the criticality analysis in place, backed up by the hierarchy, asset hierarchy. You're about to move into the FMEA process. Again, imagine that you're this person has no idea what to do. They're going to read this out of a book and they're going to lean on you for help. Yeah. What are the first things, what are the first pieces of information that you would inventory to start building out the FMEA?
So there's a couple of things first. And first, we have to build the tool, right? And so when you look at all of the columns and you get further to the right, and there's that risk priority number, which is made of severity, occurrence, and detection. Let's build out the scales for severity, occurrence, and detection first, right? Now, all three of those scales are there for different reasons, right? Severity is measuring how much it's going to hurt the business if this failure mode occurs, or if this failure mechanism appears, shows its head, mm-hmm. right? So that's severity. Now, remember last time we talked about criticality and root cause analysis being either the theoretical understanding of how much something impacts the business or a measure of the actual impact. And with the root cause analysis, we want to take those, let's take those same ideas, right? The money, the safety, the customers, let's take those groups and let's use those same ones to measure the severity, right? Let's use those. And number one, because the work's already done. Number two, because it's an accurate measure of our business. Let's build out our scales for severity, right? If this failure happens, how much does it cost? You know, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that could happen is it shuts down for, 6 months. It costs, $500 million or whatever it is. Well, then that's going to be the 10. That's going to be the top.
Okay.
Right. And what's the least that could happen? Well, it could be unnoticeable. We never even know that it happened. It doesn't impact anything. It doesn't matter. And that's going to be a one. And then we're going to scale everything in between. And I would encourage you guys to use a logarithmic scale, not a linear scale. Right. So if the top one is, $1 billion, the next one down is $500 million and the next one down is $250 million, so let's find some way to scale this so that the higher the number gets, the greater the leap it makes to start separating this particular failure mode from the distractions that might be around it. Let's let it highlight itself and stick out a little bit. Right.
Okay.
Okay. So the occurrence, how often does it occur? Right. It could occur from daily, weekly, monthly. It could occur, once every long, long time. Now, occurrence is another one where we can apply a little bit of strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll say that if you have the data, then you use the data from the CMMS. If you don't have the data, get your mechanics out there and ask them how often it happens. And if you don't have either one of those things, then make a good guess. It'll get you in the ballpark. And then as you collect the data, because now you're going to be using your CMMS, then you can revisit this in a couple of years and get a finer tune on it, right? The third category there is detection, right? Now, detection, and we've seen some generic scales out there that say, days, weeks, months, years, can you find it before or after? You can't see it at all. Is it able to be detected at all? And those are all good things, but this is what I want you to think about, is I want you to think about your business and the way your business operates. What's your definition for emergency work? What's your definition for break-in work? What's your planning horizon, right? Those types of things. How often do you do an outage? How often do you do a weekly, a weekly or a monthly regular shutdown? Because those are really, really great lines to draw between your scales, right? So detection can't be detected at all. Number 10. I can't detect it before it fails. I can't detect it after it fails. I will never know, right? It's a hidden failure. Number 9, I can't detect it before, but I can detect it immediately after. So I know that it happened because it goes, and everybody's like, there it is. So you get one of those, right? But then what do you do from there, right? Well, emergency work. For a lot of us, the definition for emergency work is if you have to do it in less than 24 hours. Well, okay, so can I detect it less than 24 hours ahead of time before the failure, right? And then break-in work is within, for a lot of us, it's within the schedule week. If I can detect it within 24 hours, can I detect it within 7 days before it happens, right? If it's, beyond that, what's your planning horizon? Can you get a job planned Or let's say you have a job plan library, and if it's identified 2 weeks ahead of time, I have time to get everything pulled and kitted and ready to go if the procedure is already written.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then if I don't have one written, what's the next horizon? Is it 4 weeks before I have time to write a new procedure, get the bill of materials, everything put together and have it kitted and planned and ready to go? So use your business to show the stratification or the delineation between your scores and detection.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Now, hopefully that makes sense in a podcast rather than visually.
It does. I think what we'll do, Brian, is we'll find a sample FMEA. We'll put some of those links in the podcast notes. When you were walking through some of those processes, I was thinking, how long do you think it should take to build the average FMEA, given that people may not have all the, if they don't have all the information handy, it's take about a week to do one of these things to figure out what the information you have and to track down the additional data?
It really doesn't take as long as it feels.
Okay.
And really, it's getting rid of all this fog shrouding, like how to do it well. Once you run through a few, you can knock out a few hundred lines a day with an entire team in the room, just focusing on what's the next question I have to answer is, the next question I have to answer is, and just blowing through, you know, line by line, getting these things done. There's also a lot of duplication where, you know, I've done a motor once. I've got another motor to do. I just have to answer the questions again. So the failure modes aren't different. The mm-hmm. criticality scores or the RPM scores are going to be different, right? So as you get going, get rolling, it starts to get easier and easier.
Okay. Right?
So set first part of setup is determining those scales, right? And do that as a team. Bring your team in. Let everybody agree on what severity, occurrence, and detection, you know, the levels 1 through 10 or whatever it is. Let everybody mm-hmm. agree on that, because they're the ones that are going to have to score it later. And you don't want them saying, but I don't agree with your definition, right? Okay. Now we go back to the beginning, and we have got our answer on what level of the hierarchy we're going to go after. And let's say we're going after level 7. This is our pump skids. This is our, you know, fan assemblies. This is, you know, things at that level. So it might be a motor, gearbox, pump, or a motor and a fan and a pulley system. You know, something like that. That's the level of asset we're going to go after. So go one level above that, draw your functional block diagram, fill out everything inside that block with those assets, right? I've got a hydraulic system. That is my system. Mm-hmm. Inside that hydraulic system, I have 20 pump skids, right? So inside that, I'm going to draw smaller blocks for the pump skids, right? And the pump skids feed into a manifold. Pump skids draw from a reservoir, right? You have piping that's involved. And so now we've got our block diagram. And what we're going to do is we're going to set ourselves up to answer all of these questions in your FMEA: functional failure, failure modes, failure mechanisms, right? With this drawing, right? Everybody likes drawing. Right. And pictures are better than words, right? Nobody loves sitting in front of an Excel spreadsheet and answering questions. That's horrible, right? So we're going to get on the whiteboard and we're going to draw this. So the question is like, well, what else do I draw? I've got the blocks. Well, what you're going to draw is the function, right? The function. So my pump system has to provide fluid, right? It's a hydraulic system. I'm going to provide fluid. How much? I don't know. Do we have the drawings? So let's assume we have the drawings, and it says we have to provide 500 gallons per minute to whatever system is downstream. 500 gallons per minute of clean hydraulic fluid, whatever it is. We've got that. Perfect, clear. What if you don't have it, right? I have to provide some amount of hydraulic fluid to this system downstream, right? So we know that we're providing hydraulic fluid, but the question is it important to get those numbers off the drawings or not? And I say it's great if you can, mm-hmm. right? But it's not critical, and this is why. When we get into our functional failures, there's really only three types of functional failures. Right? There is too much, too little, or not at all.
Okay. Right?
If I jump in the shower in the morning and the pressure is 3000 PSI and I peel my skin off, that is too much. Right?
Right.
If I jump into the shower and it's trickling out, it's still running, but it's not enough. Right? So there's too little. And if it doesn't come on at all, that's not at all. And we have the same thing with our equipment. Right? So even if I don't know it's 500 gallons per minute, I know that I have to provide hydraulic fluid, and I can provide too much hydraulic fluid, too little, or not at all.
Okay.
Right. So the same thing between each one of your components. I've got a pump skid that is supposed to provide a smaller amount of fluid. I've got a filter that's supposed to provide cleanliness to a certain degree, right? If I can't answer the question of exactly how much, I can still answer, it's supposed to be clean. It's either not clean enough, it's too clean, or it doesn't do anything at all, right? So much of those. So that brings us into the functions, helps us define the functional failures. Mm-hmm. And again, you got too much, too little, or not at all. Now, is too much a bad thing? Sometimes. Right. It doesn't matter, right? Sometimes it's like, well, too much air is okay. Too little air is where we have to have a problem, mm-hmm. right? Too much flow is fine. Too little flow is where there's a problem. So mm-hmm. sometimes you can immediately go in and say, well, functional failures, too much, too little, or not at all. The one we don't care about is too much. Mm-hmm. So let's just focus on too little or not at all.
Okay.
Sometimes the too much is, you know, hey, if you got a system that only has the capacity to hold 3,000 PSI and you pump 4,000 PSI into it and the whole thing explodes, too much is a bad thing.
Right.
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 Okay. All right. Is that making sense so far?
It is. It is. Right. I mean, you're really outlining the nuts and bolts of what it takes to know what you've got in your system and then know exactly what to evaluate in the FMEA. What's the more important failure? So what, after you start collecting different information, what's the next step?
Yes. So this is the part where I think we need to pause just for a minute and talk. Failure modes, failure mechanisms, failure indicators. A lot of these things are a little bit confusing, mm-hmm. right? So, and this is where I really struggled the first time I did it. I was like, well, what's the failure mode? You know, well, what's the definite? Tell me, I mean, in your mind, what's a failure mode?
Anything which would cause the asset to break down or not operate correctly.
Okay, so give me an example of what would cause the asset to break down.
Well, let's see.
Be specific if you want.
Using the example of your shower in the morning, let's say you've got a washer that's bent or loose and there's some sort of leak where the fluid isn't moving where it's supposed to go. It's leaking out the side. That could be one thing, right?
Right. Perfect. Okay, so what you described to me was a whole bunch of these terms lumped together into one. Right? So let's talk about a failure mode. If a failure mode, if we could define it, I would call it the deviant behavior of your component, right? Now we're talking about an asset. We're talking about a pump skid, right? But the pump skid is made up of components. So even though we're not going below the pump skid in the hierarchy, mm-hmm. We have to determine the failure modes based on the component and how it fails. So a leak from a seal, right? The leak, mm-hmm. is the deviant behavior. It's not supposed to leak,
right?
It's supposed to seal. That's the deviant behavior. So that is the failure mode, right? Now let me ask you this: do you want to do an inspection to find a failure mode?
That's a good question. I would say it depends.
Okay, it does. Tell me why.
Let's say the failure mode is a cracked pump housing. You don't need to do an inspection every day to make sure the housing is cracked. That's a less likely event, but you can see a leak. You can see the fluid pooling on the ground. So,
okay. So you described the crack, which is not a behavior. That's a condition, right?
Okay.
But the leak is a behavior, right? Okay. So do I want to inspect for the leak or do I want to find it before the leak happens?
Okay.
All right. So if a bearing seizing is the deviant behavior, do I want to wait until it seizes before I find it?
Right.
So a lot of us talk about failure mode based asset strategies, and I'm going to challenge that a little bit and say, if you're a failure mode based asset strategy, looking for the failure mode is reactive, right? Looking for the failure mechanism would be what we actually do. And it's all semantics, right? We all know that mm-hmm. we're looking for a condition before it actually turns into something bad, but I'm gonna rename this during our conversation here, say this is failure mechanism based, and we'll talk about failure indicators too. Well, the failure mechanism would be the deviant state. That is the state that ends up leading to the deviant behavior.
Okay.
Right? So if the state is misalignment, mm-hmm. right? And that misalignment results in excessive heat or excessive wear. Eventually it's going to result in the leak or the seizure or something else like that. So the deviant state is misalignment. I want to find the misalignment before it does damage.
Okay.
So now we're looking at failure mechanisms. So when you look at these things, if you get a template that says, what's the failure mode? And that's the only question it asks, put in another column and say, what's the failure mechanism? Right? Answer that question. Because if you say the failure mode is seizure, the failure mechanism is misalignment. But you know what? There's another contributor to seizures. It could be lack of lubrication. It could be over lubrication. It could be contamination. It could be a number of different things that lead to the seizure. And now I know what to look for. Oh, you know what? We frequently have seizures because of lack of lubrication. So we're going to attack lack of lubrication. How often does that happen? It happens all the time. So now our score, as we get into the RPM scores, is going to be able to differentiate between what causes the seizure so that we can look for that specific cause.
Okay.
Right? Because if it's misalignment, I need to go train everybody on how to do alignments.
Right.
Right. If it's lack of lubrication, I need to set up a lubrication route. Right.
Right.
Okay. And then we actually have a third one too. And the third one is called the failure indicator. Right. Why do you go to the doctor?
Normally when you're sick or you have a symptom of being sick.
Right. You got a symptom of being sick. And what's the symptom?
Sore throat, cough, sneezing. Okay.
And when you go and say, "Hey, hey, doc, I got a sore throat." What does the doctor does he go and say? This is what it is.
Right. No. Run a couple of tests.
Yeah. He goes, Well, it could be this. You know, it could be that. It could be, you know, bronchitis. It could be you have a cold. It could be a virus. It could be bacteria. Yeah. He's got a lot of questions, but there's an indicator that something is wrong. Right. Now we're going to run some tests and dig in further to find the failure mechanism, to find the virus, to find the bacteria, to find the imbalance, to find the hormones, whatever it is. We do the same thing in maintenance, right? If I take thermography, I can tell you that that bearing is overheating, but I can't tell you why.
Right.
All right. So failure mode is the deviant behavior. The failure indicator tells us there's a problem. The failure mechanism tells us exactly what that problem is, right? Okay. So why do I go through all that, right? It's because it costs a lot of money to inspect for the failure mechanism. And sometimes that's important. Right? If I've got a big critical asset and I need to make sure this thing never fails, I don't mind doing a semi-annual alignment check. And I don't mind doing a lubrication and checking for, you know, and doing precision lubrication and checking to make sure it's right. And I don't mind changing filters and testing my oil to make sure that there's no contamination, because I want to find those mechanisms as early as I can to remove them so that no damage is done to my asset. But when I get down to my pump bank and to do that same level of inspection is a bit painful, I'm going to take a step back and I'm going to look for the failure indicator. I might do thermography because I can do everything all in one big picture, or, you know, very quickly by going asset to asset and taking pictures. And if there's a problem, then I'll go back to that asset and I'll start digging in. Is it lubrication? Is it alignment? Is it whatever? Right. But I can very quickly get a bigger picture. And then back to your original point, maybe sometimes we inspect for the failure mode. If the criticality of that asset is low enough, then maybe we let the operator tell us when there's an actual degradation in performance. Right? And that's okay. All right.
Right. And indicators could be something like product quality, for example. If you're on the frozen pizza line, the pizzas are off center, or there's not enough ingredients on one, you know, they can mention the machine isn't operating as it should be.
Right. Right. So that makes sense so far?
It does. It does. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Because the next question we got to answer is, what are the failure effects? Right. And I have seen templates of this where the failure effects are, well, the machine stopped running, or, you know, it affects quality, or, you know, this or that or the other, all the way to it blows up and, you know, it's a big explosion and somebody gets hurt. But I want to tie this to something that helps us downstream. We already calculated, we already developed our scale for severity. I want you to write down the answer to failure effects in terms of the severity. So the money, which is profitability or revenues or downtime or, you know, uptime or however you measure that aspect, the safety, you know, how safe people are, how much damage it does to people or equipment, you know, and then the customer, you know, does this hit the EPA and everybody says, well, we can't do business with them anymore because they spilled a bunch of oil, or, you know, they did X, Y, or Z, or, you know, they blew up half the state. You know, and can't do business with them anymore. So failure effects in those specific terms, because in a minute we're going to ask you what's the severity, and when you say the failure effect was, it causes 6 hours of downtime, or loss of, you know, $20,000 in production, or it's a minor injury, not OSHA recordable, or, you know, a minor release into the environment. If you stated it in those terms, then when you go to severity and you say, hey, team, what's the severity of this? They go directly to that spot and they say, oh, it's a six. You've already defined it.
And if I could take just a step backwards and look at the bigger picture, this is the connection that, from what I've been able to gather, some plant teams, it takes a while to connect what they're doing with the cost of the business. And,
yes.
But this is what we all often preach as an industry, which is understand the value of your work to the business, understand the connection between the scale you developed and severity, and then connecting the effect of the failure to it. Have you seen a lot of like light bulbs go on when you get to this part of the FMEA and people start making saying, okay, the effect is linked back in this way. Oh, wait, we're costing this much money where it could hurt this many people.
Yeah, it definitely does. When you start breaking this down and going through and you coach them, like, this is how you build your severity scale. This is how you answer failure effects. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, then it's like, oh, I get it now. Like, why are you asking me how this affects the business? That doesn't matter to me. That's too big. I'm just talking about my area of the mill.
Right.
You know, no, your area of the mill is for a bigger purpose. Well, we're all here for something bigger. You know what I mean?
Right.
They didn't hire us just to go inside of our little box and do our own thing. This is for somebody else.
Right. Right.
Right.
So, okay.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to do a gut check and make sure that made sense with what you've experienced.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I want to hit one more thing before we're done. Right. So we answer severity, answer recurrence. How often does it happen? Answer detection. How early can you find it? We get our RPN score. Okay, great. Right. And then we all know the next thing to do is to sort our RPN scores and bring the biggest ones up to the top. And then we're going to recommend some different actions in order to bring that RPN score down. But do we have a strategy for bringing them down? Right. So what am I going to do? Well, let's throw PDM at it. Okay. Does that actually fix it?
Mm.
Right. Does PDM lower the score, or is the detection already very early? Right. Because if detection is a very low score, throwing predictive technologies as it, you know, going from a 2 to a 1 really doesn't do a whole lot for the score. Going from a 10 to a 1, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we're multiplying it. So for those of you who don't know, we're multiplying together severity times occurrence times detection. The max score is about 1,000. So if I've got a very high detection score, meaning it's very hard to detect, and I throw something at it that brings that score way down, right?
All right.
So look at your RPN score, the components of it. Which one is the highest? Is it severity? Is it occurrence? Or is it detection?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's say that severity is the highest. What can we do to revert to reduce the severity of a failure? What are the tools we have? What are the levers we can pull? Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts? Any ideas?
Again, not having been hands-on in a plant like this, I would think some of the levers are, number one, establish better routes, or number one, see which routes are not helping you, and so you can free up time to do more specific work.
Okay. Well, if we think about a bearing, let's say the bearing seizure on this one motor that is the single point of failure in this big process, right? So if it seizes, you know, we're pretty much done.
Yeah.
Right. And the motor takes 6 months to build, and it's $1.5 million. You know, so basically the whole plant's going to be shut down for 6 months. This is a severe, right?
Right.
So you have a couple of levers that you can pull to reduce the severity. You know, one of those things is re-engineering.
Mm. Okay.
Right? I can re-engineer this so that the severity is less. I can install a second one right next to it.
Mm.
Right. Now, if I have two of them and one of them goes down, the other one runs while we go spend 6 months buying the backup, right?
Mm-hmm.
Policies and procedures that protect the asset. Right. Mm. Having a critical spare on standby.
Okay. Right?
Having a critical spare. That's a warehousing policy. Well, if this thing takes 6 months, then we're going to get it built right now and we're going to put it in the warehouse. And that way, if it happens, then it's not going to be 6 months. It's going to be 6 days. to bring the whole crews together, lift this thing out with a crane, you know, rip off the roof, whatever we have to do, put the new one in, you know, and get it back together. But 6 days is way better than 6 months.
Right.
Now we've come from a 10 to a 7 or
okay.
whatever the score is, right? So severity can be affected by a few different things. You know, you want to remove the problem altogether, probably can't do it, re-engineer it out, or policies or procedures that protect the people or the assets that, you know, is causing the severity. You know, so something blowing up and killing somebody, that's pretty severe, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
can you remove the people from that?
Okay.
Hey, we're going to do this a little different and we're going to put guarding between us and the problem.
Yeah.
Well, that lowers the severity. Now, if a tire blows up inside of a cage, it doesn't blow somebody clear across the parking lot, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
We were just looking at tires being filled up, so that one was right in my head, right? So severity has certain things you can do, but occurrence is different. Occurrence, what could you do to reduce the frequency in occurrence? How do you make it happen less? How do you make the bearing
right.
seizure happen less?
Well, that's where I think PM would come in, where you take a look and see what would make it happen, and you find out what mechanically you can do on a regular basis to reduce the impact of that, whether it's greasing it regularly, whether it's taking predictive readings once a month, whether it's putting something that's say a wireless automatic lubricator on there, where it's monitoring the frequency and lubing when necessary, that sort of thing.
Yep, totally. So occurrence can be affected through the things that we do to reduce how often it happens. And we're going to get up in the precision realm, right? Precision maintenance, maintenance procedures. So having a good job plan library a lot of times can reduce that. Training operators for how to operate the asset so they don't break it. Adding a lubrication route, adding that PM inspection or something along those lines so that, let me differentiate there, that goes to detection. But adding the things that are going to make sure that you don't get to that failure to begin with, right? So that's the precision, that's the lubrication, that's the training and how we operate, right? And then detection is the same thing. If detection score is high, right, then that means that we can't see it coming. So then we want to throw in the things that help us see it coming. PM inspection activity, predictive technologies, increased inspection frequency, maybe even using data to alarm us of a condition as it's coming. We got a data available. Why aren't we using it, right?
Right.
So
right.
those types of things. So when you get to the very end of this thing, making a recommended action that's going to lower the score based on what component of your RPM score is the highest.
Okay.
Maybe put two things in place.
Yeah.
Bring it way down, right? But that's the strategy.
Yeah, it just to bring it back around to what comes next. I mean, this exercise is a tool that's been developed to help plant teams develop stronger equipment maintenance plans, in essence, to identify the kinds of work that need to be done. And again, the FMEA itself is not the recipe for work. It's the analysis to determine what is the best work for this asset. Sorry, that may sound like I'm restating the obvious what we were talking about. But again, it's sometimes when it comes to the all the different kinds of maintenance tools out there, it can be confusing as to what leads to what. So I just wanted to make sure that we were building that connection in there.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. You know, you're reminding me too. I had a conversation at Marcon with Lee McLeish, who I think you know. He's working with a data center company. He's a reliability engineer there. And he was saying that, interestingly, data centers have such a high degree of redundancy built into the hardware that the reliability approach changes. And it when you talked about what can you do to mitigate the severity of these things, building in redundancy, building in, say, a critical spare, for example.
Yep.
You know, in Lee's world, the data center engineers have built in a lot of critical spares on the hardware side. What he's there to evaluate, he says, is, okay, what's the HVAC system like? Do we have enough filters?
Yeah.
Do we have enough replacement parts to make sure that all the redundant hardware in the data center actually stays cool?
Yeah. And they're working, I mean, with data, you're working with, you know, close to 100% availability, and that's hard to achieve, you know, which is why they got to use redundancy, you know. So for keeping that stuff cool, you're shooting for pretty close to 100 too.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise the data goes away.
Wow. Well, I think we're at the end here. We'll put some information in the podcast notes about what an FMEA looks like, a couple of tip sheets that Brian's got on how to build these things out. Just to wrap it up, if someone was directed to either build an FMEA, or we're told, okay, we need these things. Some manager heard these at a conference. What's the first thing you do as a reliability point person to start building these things?
Get other people involved, right? Okay. A lot of times we kind of take our jobs like, you know, it's the lone ranger, the lone guy in the corner. It's my job to be the reliability guy. I'm going to take care of all this. And everybody kind of expects that because they don't really know what we do. The challenge that brings in is that we don't have enough data to go by to build these things. You have to have those mechanics in the room to be able to answer questions, the electricians, the operators. You need the other managers to help you understand the context of how this affects the business, like what's most important to them. And then you have to be able to go the other direction and educate them on, okay, this is what we're going to do and this is why. And it's because of the concerns that you've given to me. Our job as reliability engineers is to solve other people's problems, right? So if we're not solving other people's problems, then, or if we don't even know what those problems are, you can't do anything. So get other people in the room, build these tools out, agree on the definitions so that everybody will agree to take action on whatever you output. And then you've got a better start already.
Excellent. No, that's terrific advice. And I know team building is a whole separate conversation.
Totally separate conversation.
But no, it's if you're asked to be doing this, you're not alone. Draw your whole team in. So,
yep.
Thanks, Brian. I know I'll see you in a couple of weeks, actually more like in about 2 months down at Leading Reliability in Clearwater, Florida. It's a conference that is co-sponsored by Iridicio in conjunction with partners UE Systems, ACOM, and RDI Technologies. And so, Brian, if we don't talk before then, hope I'll see you there soon.
I'll see you at Plant Services. So,
Thank you. Yeah. And again, for those who are listening to this podcast, you can get the other podcast episodes on Great Question Manufacturing Podcast on Podbean or wherever you get your podcasts. So, and also we have all episodes listed on plantservices.com. So thanks, Brian. Talk again soon.
Thank you, Tom.